You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast in association with Las Hu. Las Hu gives fans the opportunity to book live video chats with an incredible roster of sports stars. Las Hu is a new must-have app for any sports fan. Whether you want to book your hero for a one-to-one conversation, give a truly unique gift to a friend or family member, organise a keynote speaker for your event, or even some inspirational words ahead of your local club's big game, Las Hu have got you covered. By downloading the Las Hu app, users can search for and book hero speakers from around the world within minutes, including a wide range of current and ex-cricketers. The app allows you to set an agenda, ensuring everyone is prepared and at ease, and that every minute of every call is spent on the topics you are most interested in. And with no travel time or additional costs, organising a Las Hu experience couldn't be simpler. We've got friend of the show, CricViz analyst Ben Jones with us. I'm Yaz Rana, and today I'm joined by the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. England supremo Chris Silverwood unveiled his 17-man squad for this winter's Ashes. The ECB statement was at pains to say that this was the strongest available squad. There were recalls for Zach Crawley and Don Best, no room for Dom Sibley, Matt Parkinson, Ben Foulkes, or Saqib Mood. I think it's fair to say that there was one big collective shrug at the announcement. I wonder if this is the earliest England fans on the whole have given up hope. I received a text at 12:05, genuinely, from a mate who said, we'll be lucky to walk away 5-0 with that squad.
No, last time was probably worse.
Do you reckon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last time was worse because there were some players in there that people didn't really know, let alone back. I think last time was even worse.
Okay. Although that would, people not knowing players causes a bit of excitement because they might be better than they actually are.
Yeah, but that is possibly a false position to adopt anyway, isn't it?
Well, Joe, it isn't the most exciting squad, but would you have done much different?
Well, I was going to ask, who did your friend expect them to pick?
It was just more the realisation of this is what we've got.
Right, because I'd already got to that point. That's sort of my job.
Yeah.
There's a few you could quibble on. I would certainly have gone Parkinson over Best. You could say Foulkes is a bit unlucky, but I also Bairstow's got an Ashes Test 100 over there in his back pocket. I can see that's potentially useful. And to be honest, those calls, the reserve keeper and the second choice spinner when the first choice spinner might not even play, they're not going to decide the series. I think England have got what they got. And Joe Root's going to have to do something pretty masterful again. The concern is the bowling attack. I don't know if you're going to come to it. We got an interesting email from someone.
The batting as well. Back's a problem.
Fielding's not great either. The catch is.
But I think
worst slip fielders in the game apart from Bangladesh.
There are loads of problems, but I think that it was not very long ago that we were talking about suddenly England have got some fast bowlers who might be able to do a bit of damage in Australia, and kind of one by one, we've lost them, and now it's kind of Mark Wood flying the flag for pace. But yeah, I think we got an email from someone saying that he was listening to previous shows, which is always slightly problematic.
From a year ago.
And we were talking quite brightly about England's batting hopes at that point. I think he'd said kind of what's gone wrong.
Well, England have had they've only played the best two teams in the world in their last 10 or so test matches, and a lot of guys who we had a lot of hopes for earlier in the year have struggled, understandably so. That's basically what's happened. And also we had another question from Alec Watson, who was talking about the obsession about 90 mile per hour X factor bowlers to win in Australia. We had three of them a year ago, and at the moment only one's fit. Before we go to you, Ben, Phil, you had suggested earlier that you weren't so downbeat.
Look, I mean, a case can be made. I've made no notes on this, right? I haven't really thought about it. I think the way that you summed it up was bang on, actually. There was a sort of collective shrug. I felt slightly sad, because it did really bring into focus that they could have really taken out their a bowling attack that certainly seam bowling attack that could have really made some dents, albeit on some pretty dead, nasty drop-in pitches, which we should come to later, I think. There could have been a case made, obviously, if you'd had the best all-rounder in the world out there, one of the best fast bowlers around, and as well, you know, a potential bolter in someone like Ollie Stone. None of them are going to be there. Stokes, we possibly might latter half of the series, but that's probably pie in the sky. So, yeah, it felt, looking at that squad, a bit demoralising instinctively. And there is an absence of colour and fantasy in there, and we all have our own prejudices, and we all have our own hobby horses, if you like, you know. And people can legitimately say, well, you know, why is there not a wrist spinner there, and why is there not a proper stroke maker in there, you know, who's made a few runs out in Australia and plays the quicks well on flat tracks. We can all kind of make these kinds of cases, but I don't think there's a kind of not taking Gower to India in 93 scandal. I don't see the MCC being bombarded by, you know, furious members and votes of no confidence in the selectors, because I don't see that there was this kind of, you know, sort of disappointingly flat, humdrum approach, really. I think they've done what they can do overall. I'd have personally liked to have seen Parkinson in there in the 17. It's worth pointing out the caveat that they will all be there anyway, that they'll all be playing against one another in various warm-up games in the build-up to it. So, you know, if Parkinson goes out there and takes 7 or 8, then he will be moved into that squad, probably played at Sydney, and take 0 for 170. It's frustrating, because that conversation that we'd have had a year or so ago would have been legitimately fine. You know, in Ollie Pope and Zach Crawley this time last year, you had two quality young players coming through. You had a cohort of quality quicks. And you had in Joe Root, a player who just needed to find a bit of form. Well, now he's found form and a bit more on top of it. And yet you feel like he is going to be going out there as a lone figure. I'm pleased that Butler's signed up for it, and I think he's probably owed a bit of an apology on this show and elsewhere, because there is this assumption, this kind of lazy assumption, because he had been the first to speak out of the group and say, look, you know, we're not going to go through this unless we get a few concessions. And even up to last week, we were saying, well, Butler might not play. Butler probably won't go. Casually, because he's a white ball icon. Well, he is there. And my personal feeling, and I've been saying it since last summer, is that Butler in Australia is a defining moment in the bloke's career. And if you are looking for crumbs of comfort, scintillas of optimism, then Butler at 6 or 7 in Australia, when the ball is not doing too much laterally, that is a potentially interesting scenario for England. The obvious glaring problem is how, on those pitches, and that is a problem, big problem. They are characterless pitches now in Australia. How the hell they are going to take 20 wickets while simultaneously batting dry, long, and kind of bloodlessly for 5-6 sessions? It's a hard one to square. One tiny aside, Australia aren't that good either. So it really is a scrap between two very fallible and very vulnerable teams.
India won there without they're having their gun quick available for much of the series last year. Ben, I think a lot of the frustration stems from England have won one test match in 9, and keeping the same group of players when you're not actually winning is a bit frustrating. And I think you can, in red ball and white ball cricket now, kind of point to Chris Silverwood's time as selector, not just coach, but just a selector, as not being particularly imaginative. He's not picked anyone who wasn't picked already by Ed Smith previously. And I think if you go back a selection like James Bracey was quite interesting. James Bracey was probably one of the most Ed Smith picks, in that he was picked for an England Lions squad of very, very, very little, kind of stayed around the England group, then does well on an inter-squad warm-up, and then basically stays around the England group, changes selector, he's still there. You kind of wonder, Chris Silverwood is around county cricket for a long time, if he does he not have a strong opinion about a batter who's out of the England group? What do you think about the kind of lack of, I guess, colour in the selections?
I guess it's hard in a way, isn't it? Because, I mean, Chris Silverwood physically can't watch much county cricket anymore, which is, I think, partly why it was so absurd that they got rid of the Ed Smith role. I mean, I think it was... You can have your opinions on Ed Smith as a selector. I broadly was quite in favour of him. I think he did a pretty good job. And actually, when you look back at his record, obviously cricketers win games of cricket, selectors don't. But I think what he did across a good period for English Test cricket at home and away from home, you know, they didn't stand up. But I don't think that was really on him. I think he did what he could. But to get rid of the role, I think is a really big issue for English cricket going forward, for this exact reason that Silverwood's now in a position where if he doesn't already have those strong opinions about guys in county cricket, he's not going to make them now because he can't watch anything, because he's the only guy who's coaching every format of England's, you know, international cricket and meant to be picking the team. So he's speaking to the scouts and getting all those opinions, but you don't get that instinct that you hope that these guys who are paid the big bucks to pick the England team, that's what you're paying for. You're paying for their knowledge and expertise to look at Zach Crawley, you know, making 60 on a, you know, on a wet one at Canterbury and thinking, actually, no, he's got something. You need that instinct to come through, and Silverwood's not going to get that opportunity. One thing I would just take issue is I don't think it's fair to say that he's been unimaginative, because in a quite high proportion of his tests away from home, they've not picked a spinner. Now you can say that's badly imaginative, but it is still quite a strong tactic to say, you know what, none of our spinners are any good, we're just going to pick the seamers. It may well be wrong. Personally, I think, is, you know, some of those flat pitches in New Zealand to go in with five seamers was a big tactical error. But at the very least, they're trying things. And, you know, Ed Smith tried things by picking wrist spinners and chucking Jason Roy to the top of the order. Some of them are success, some of them not. Silverwood's tried that. It's just that the way he's being imaginative is, I think, quite appropriately, quite boring. It's like picking another military medium. I do just think the fundamental reason why I think the response to the squad announcement has been so meh, and everyone's kind of shrugged their shoulders and depressedly gone, yeah, we're probably going to lose 5-0, is because there are so many caveats to the squad announcement as well. And everyone kind of goes, yeah, we know the squad was a difficult situation to put a squad together in terms of getting them out there for COVID reasons. That's clearly a big caveat on picking the best players. And they've done well to get to this position where they're all going. And we also have the caveat of all the injuries. So you're kind of there being like, it feels quite callous to instinct to like kick off and say, you know, why we're going to get battered again. Whereas actually just kind of a dry acceptance of, yeah, this is probably the best we've got. They're not that good. It feels a bit more appropriate. I reckon they'll win a test for what it's worth.
Also, silver lining, this could have been a hell of a lot worse. I mean, if you look at that squad and go there, I mean, there'd have been some new names, but I mean, we were talking about Joe Root possibly not going this time last week, 2 weeks ago. So, you know, at least it should be a contest, even if it's not one that many of us think England will come out on top from.
Can I ask you, Joe, so you'd be tempted by Parkinson for Bess if you were picking it?
I would do that, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Any seamers? Saki Mahmood, maybe?
Saki Mahmood is the one that jumps out. The squad...
How is Saki's side? That was the only thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they've not said he's not fit, have they? But yeah, but maybe that is a concern. I mean, I would have been certainly tempted to add him or potentially have him maybe over Overton. I don't know. The squad was smaller than I was expecting as well, which is, again, a part of the reason why I think everyone's a bit like a meh, because you would, even if it'd been 19 and you had, say, Parkinson or Mahmood or I mean, Vince would have got a lot of people angry, but have also excited people, or proper wildcard Livingston, then there would have at least been a little bit more kind of something to it.
That's a really good point, actually, because you had larger home squads this summer, so it's basically just the home squad plus I think it's just Crawley.
Well,
sometimes
and Bess. There were 17 person squads, yeah, at home, so I don't think there's many people in the squad who people were like, oh god, I can't believe they've picked them. I think it's the squad that you expected, just minus a couple of kind of more fun picks in a way.
On Parkinson, I know that, yeah, I'm very much in the spiritual home of Matthew Parkinson here. I don't need to talk about how good he is. But one thing I want to just mention is we did a bit of quite detailed research into the guys that could be picked for the England squad at Cricviz. And one thing that we found with Parkinson is that we talk about the idea that finger spinners can go out there and bowl dry and bowl, you know, bowl 35 overs in a day and be accurate. Now, Jack Leach can do that. We know he is incredibly methodical and accurate and reliable in that. But if you're taking Don Best is not accurate. He doesn't hold up an end. I know he did once in South Africa early enough in his career that it became a narrative that he could do that. His economy is worse than Matt Parkinson's. And Parkinson is essentially the most accurate wrist spinner in first-class cricket at the moment. He is extremely good at hitting a spot. Now, I think it's just nice to make that point and say that he's not this one-dimensional magic bolt ball bowler who, you know, lives on GIFs online and, you know, you see the good stuff and you don't see the drag downs. He doesn't really bowl those drag downs. He is a very accurate bowler. And I think if you were looking, one of the ways that England are going to have to go in this series is if they pick a spinner, then all of a sudden the balance of the team goes a little bit and you're going to have Chris Wokes at number seven and things are going to look a bit wonky. And if you're going to do that and you're going to make those sacrifices to have more bowlers, having a bit of variety, i.e. Parkinson and Leach is fine. They turn the ball the same way. That's okay. It's not against the law. I think that would give them a little bit more of an aggressive cutting edge. And that's not because Parkinson, yeah, like I say, drag down magic ball. He is just a very, very good, reliable red ball bowler. And I think it is a mistake. And I think they've made it easier for them to not get criticised. Because I think it's a squad that's almost picked to respectfully lose in that respect. To go over there and, you know, really try our hardest, a bit like 17-18. Whereas Pete Parkinson, he could get whacked. He could get destroyed. But I think it would give you a chance of winning a test.
I just thought Chris Silverwood was accidentally quite funny on Parkinson's omission. He said, Parky's an interesting option too. He's a wicket taker and he's something a little bit different, but unfortunately he didn't get the nod this time, which is quite amusing.
The thing is with Parkinson, we can all look at it, we can all drill down, we can all make our suppositions, but he was with England for what, 3 months last winter, in conditions that you would have thought would be anywhere in the world, that's where he would want to bowl. And he bowled five overs in a practice game. And he was there for 3 months. He is a well-established white ball wrist spinner in 20-over cricket in particular. And he's not made Morgan's cut for his team either. They don't know what to do with him aside from leave him out. That's their conclusion at this point. Now, it may evolve and change. And a few more high-profile performances next summer and so on may change it again. But as it stands, and they will have faced him day after day after day, and they'd have done all the research and all the data and so on, they're not ignoring Warne here, you know. The subtext could be, this is English cricket playing it safe yet again. A kind of an echo, say, of the 06-07 tour when Giles played instead of Panesar because, you know, Fletcher wanted a player who could catch and bat nine. So that's why Best gets in there ahead of Parkinson. It could be another echo of that, English cricket playing it conservative and playing it safe. Possibly there's a narrative there. But I don't think they are deliberately cutting their nose off here, you know. And they will have watched him far more closely than any of us. And the batsmen who make a big decision, they have a big influence on these things. Ollie Robinson made his test debut because they faced him for the week building up to Lords and they said he's got to play. These boys would have been facing Matt Parkinson at that level for months and months and months.
But who's the one boy who is probably having the biggest say over that? It's probably, you know, J.E. Root, who actually quite a good player of spin. So if you're waiting along for an English spinner who can challenge Joe Root, you're going to be waiting 30, 40 years. So I think you've got to, at some point, you've got to say, lads, he's the second best we've got. Just really quickly, the other end of the spectrum in terms of exciting picks, and I know it's maybe my most boring opinion, is that I'm now a big Sibley guy. I'm quite distressed about it as a turn of events. But I think it's a really poor decision to not take Sibley to Australia, because the one thing that he is really good at is seeing off the new ball, and he is extremely good at batting long. And yeah, he might get roasted a couple of times by Pat Cummins, but if you're thinking that Hamid and Burns and Crawley aren't going to have that problem as well, then you're fooling yourself. In Australia, the first 30 overs, the ball swings, and then it does nothing. So if you pick openers who are going to blunt the ball and leave the ball outside of stump, Sibley has one of the highest averages outside of stump of anyone in the data era. It's the last 15, 20 years of Test cricket. He is brilliant outside of stump. He doesn't nick off, really, for an opening batsman in England. So actually, pick that guy and then solve the problems down the order. Even if he goes and plays one test and then gets dropped, I think.
You think you'd pick him? You'd take him, but you'd also pick him for the first test?
Yeah, I'd pick him for the first test. I genuinely really hope I'm proved wrong about Zach Crawley, but I think the idea that Zach Crawley has got a technique for Australia. We said that about James Vince on the last tour, and he did fine. Also played the greatest test innings of all time at Brisbane. But I think the idea that just because you're a back foot player means you're going to do really well in Australia is a little bit of a sneaky fallacy that English cricket often falls back on. Crawley may smash it out there, but I think it's a hell of a gamble to think that the lad who averages 30 in first-class cricket, just because you've spotted something, and he's had one incredible innings against Pakistan, I would rather back the lad who went to South Africa last time and had that incredible partnership with Stokes and batted all day and batted long and set up that win on the final day. I just think they had a method there, and they've been speaking about it for 2 years. Bat big, bat once, bat long, old-fashioned, conservative Tory test cricket. That was the model. And they've basically said, nah, Haas is going to go. And as much as I love Haseeb Hameed, I don't think anyone's expecting him to make big runs in Australia with those low hands and an average of less than 30 against pace in first-class cricket. I'm very sceptical.
Joe, I was going to ask you about Crawley. The central contracts were released this week, and Crawley not in the team, averaging 11 in 2021. He has one, and Haseeb Hameed doesn't have one. Do you think that suggests that he's going to play that first test match? And do you think that's the right thing if he does?
I don't think he'll play the first test, and I'm not really against the fact that they took him. I can see some sense in it. Over Sibley and Crawley, I'd marginally go Crawley, I think, in terms of who I would take. I was surprised to see him get a contract. I think that is a slightly odd message to send out after the year he's had. I mean, you in 6 months we could say what a genius move it was to give a guy who's averaged, 11 in test cricket over the year and to show confidence in him, and then he comes good. But at the moment, given the fact he's not in the white ball setup, it looks odd that he's got one, I think.
He made 60-odd, didn't he, in the...
Johannesburg test match.
No, in the ODI series that Stokes was involved in.
Yes.
And after his 267, albeit he was obviously buzzing, he went and smashed a 50-ball 100 for Kent and
good,
so on.
Good white ball player, yeah.
I think against Shaheen as well.
I was quite pleased to see his name in that list, personally, for what it's worth. He's had the mother of bad runs, and it might carry on. And he might be a failed test player. But this is a lad that 12 months ago, everybody sat around saying, oh, he's special. I interviewed Ted Dexter. He says he's the best young player I've seen in years. He says he's the best player I've seen since Joe Root, when Joe Root came through, and he looked absolutely marvellous. Everybody was saying it. Young, old, black, white, man, woman, everyone's saying he's class. And the numbers have been horrific since, no question. But what do you do? If you're the England selectors, what do? You look at a player that everybody's backed, and they've backed him hard, and he's what, 23, 24?
Yeah, 23.
And he clearly has a natural ball striking talent that can be converted across into white ball cricket as well. So why not back the bloke? For the sake of a few quid, why not back the bloke? Why not say, you know, you are a part of our future, not just in red ball cricket, but in white ball cricket as well, potentially. That will make him feel so much better about life. And if you believe that there is a player in there, then why not try and find every which way to try and drag that player back out of his slump?
I think I agree, and I think that does stack up to a point, and I think this will be, you know, one, it was still to be judged, but I can see why they've done it. I think it is the issue, or one of the issues, of Silverwood's role, which I think none of us agree with, that he's both selector and head coach, that he is always going to be open to accusations of showing too much loyalties to players who are part of the group, because he is the head coach, and Butch has talked about this before, that they should be performing completely different roles, and those two conflict with each other. And I think there is going to be an inclination for Silverwood to give some players too many chances because he is so close to them as the coach. And I think it's just a completely unnecessary issue that England have created for themselves by setting the hierarchy up in this space, or basically having no hierarchy other than Silverwood. It seemed a really odd decision at the time, and as every week goes by, it seems more and more odd.
Yeah, it's sorry, go for it, Ben.
No, I was just going to say, Smith was far from an idiot, but in some respects, he was a useful idiot, if you go with that line of, like, people could dump all their problems within
useful genius.
He was a useful maverick genius. But I think to an extent that was actually quite a useful role for the ECB and for English cricket generally, to be able to be like, oh, it was, you know, quirky Ed Smith. Probably, you know, that's the main issue at the moment. There's only two guys in English cricket who have any, you know, to the public facing people, have any power, and it's Root and Silverwood, and one of them's having one of the greatest ever years any player's ever had, so you're not going to criticise him. Silverwood's going to take a lot of stick.
Angus Fraser said this to Taha for the piece he did on the kind of the history of the England selectors and where they've gone, that Fraser said, yeah, well, we're fully aware that we are there to take the flak so the captain and coach can deflect some of it. And that is a perfectly functional part of the job. And, you know, it's not always fair. Sometimes it's unjust, but that's just how it goes. And now it's just too much of it is aimed at one bloke who a lot of people have reservations if he's good enough for either role, let alone both.
Hearing you guys talk about Crawley, I do think that we should probably be... I guess that's not a particularly boring selection, given the year he's had.
That's true.
So, but we all knew it was going to happen.
That.
And also, at the risk... of further destroying what's left of my reputation, right? Not only Haseeb Hameed is clearly a gamble of a selection, but Dan Lawrence is also a gamble of a selection. Now, all right, get your klaxon out, whatever. But it is, if we're talking about whether it's safe or not, to take Lawrence, Hameed and Crawley, you know, you can't really be accused of being ultra-conservative if you're taking those three. You're taking them on talent. You're not taking them on results. Now, they've been pushed into that, corner.
Lawrence's results with the Lions, though, would have had to come into that conversation, right?
I'm glad that you said that, Joe, because if I had, I'd get it in the neck again. But yeah, the last time he was out there, he literally averaged 100, right? And he took a good Australia A team down for 130-odd, admitted on day one of that test match. Admittedly, so did your boy Sibley. He also got 100 on that day. But Lawrence made 125, 197, and a couple of other big runs in the ODIs as well, in the one day equivalents as well. So that kind of technique in England, you think, sure, a lot of moving parts, etc., etc. That kind of technique and that ball striking ability in Australia, then you kind of think, all right, there might be something in that.
Mm. Yeah, we will talk more specifically about the makeup of the England team in the weeks to come. But I really, really hope that England don't just have the same balance to the side they've had this summer, where they've, especially when they've only got one all-rounder in the squad in Chris Wokes, which the balance of the side has basically been all-rounder at seven plus four bowlers. I really do want to see England, at least for some test matches, have six bats, keeper, four bowlers. Anyway, plenty of
time. Do you have that power?
Pardon?
Do you have that power yet?
He's getting there.
Wisdom supremo. Can I just say really, really quickly, I think that one of the... You know, coming into the Ashes, we know that over the last few years, it's become a little bit cool in some ways to be like, oh, you know, the Ashes is rubbish. And the phony war stuff is still absolutely tedious as hell. But...
Do you know what's tedious? People moaning about the phony war.
I'm moaning about the phony war now. So I think people are going to go back the other way. I'm preempting the backlash to the backlash to the backlash.
Didn't you tweet the other day, sort of cancel the Ashes? All right, I know you're
funny. The other 12 hours ago.
Wedged in your cheek, for sure. But this is not on you, Ben Jones. It's not on you. But it does drive me up to all the phony war, the phony war. Like when phonies on both sides sort of try to defone themselves by calling out phonyism on the other side, and it's thus perpetuating the phony war.
Where are you on this scale?
Me? I'm just indifferent. I'm angrily indifferent.
Just right in the middle. Just absolutely perfect. What I was going to say was that the phony war is boring, and I don't care whether it's annoying, Phil. I'm a annoying cricket hipster.
People who
person.
Get annoyed with it annoy me.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. I know I'm irritating you. But what I was going to say is that on the first morning of the Ashes, wherever the hell it ends up being, because who knows where that's going to be, I will be as excited as anyone in the world.
Because
it's the Ashes, and it's brilliant. Well, World Cup before then. But it'll be good, no matter what squad we pick, and we lose 5-0.
Rob Wildman asks, is there any hope whatsoever of Ben Stokes making an appearance in the Ashes? His tweet yesterday, seems a step towards a return. I think this is quite interesting. So on Thursday, the ECB released a statement saying that Stokes had undergone a second operation on his dodgy finger and included the line, he will now undergo an intensive period of rehabilitation for the next 4 weeks under the supervision of the ECB's medical team. For a guy who's taking an indefinite break on mental health grounds, I thought it was quite odd to give such a specific time frame, which also happens to be roughly the time when the squad travels to Australia.
That is a fair point. I mean, I thought it was revealing that the picture that he posted yesterday, where he said it was the first time he'd been able to get his little finger around the bat handle since March or April.
Yeah, so when he's playing for England.
So he's captain to England in that time. That must have been tough. Mm. I mean, I'm not a batting expert, but if you can't hold a bat, that's going to be pretty tricky.
Since you knew backlift, though, you're
just that's true.
Stat to get you all excited. England haven't taken 20 wickets in a Gabba test match since 1986.
Yeah, well, they had Australia hadn't lost at the Gabba since the 80s, and that's already gone. So it's a time for records to get in.
Absolutely.
Just in 86-7, England didn't have any proper quicks. And in 10-11, they didn't have any proper quicks either. That's all I'll say.
But in answer to the actual Stokes question, will he make any appearances? Phil, you were saying earlier you think you wouldn't be surprised if he crops up at some stage?
I feel like we've been here before.
I don't think we have, actually.
I feel like we have to tread very carefully around the subject with Ben Stokes. It was the talk of the town last week at the Cricket Writers nonsense. And I was around this weekend. I saw some people. They were all asking, is he going to play? Is he going to play? What I mean is that we've been here before. That was 4 years ago. That was the same sort of conversation. I don't think there's any doubt about the authenticity of what he's been going through. It has been confused somewhat by the finger thing and the ECB statement. Not like them to slightly kind of conflate two different issues and end up with a bit of a mesh. I would not be surprised. I would not be shocked if at some point he features before now and what would it be, the middle of January. I would not be shocked. But if he can't make it, then of course people respect that and you just hope to see him again in an England shirt at some point next year. He will obviously feel immensely dutiful towards Joe Root on a cricketing level because of what happened last time and Root was out there on his own, denuded of his best man, as we know. Stokes and Root go back to when they were 10 year old. So he will feel on a certain level, and as the story, hets up and we get to that point, he wouldn't be a human being if he didn't start getting excited. And then, of course, he realizes I might still yet be able to influence matters, possibly. Look, it's so much speculation, and we should park the Ben Stokes story from here on in. But I thought this is interesting. Now, as he sent that message out without discussing it with Harvey Fairbrother, his agent, and the ECB, possibly. But it seemed like if you want to read something into it, then there's enough to be read into that moment, for sure. And if he is just physically holding a bat at the moment, then it suggests that he's possibly getting back into that kind of spirit with the game, And it's also possible that what's happened with his finger has impacted on his mental health and vice versa. I mean, a cricketer's nothing without their fingers, right? So, that's his livelihood in his hand. So it's possible that coming out of the side physically may actually help him psychologically as well. Look, it's all speculation, and we shouldn't really talk about it. And we just wish him well, I think my antenna went up just like everybody else's did.
It was just that sensation of in 17-18 when there was that picture that someone snapped of him at the airport.
Yeah, that was my fault. That was my fault. So yeah,
I was going to call you out on that. It was Felix. I couldn't quite remember the details.
It was Felix actually. Felix's mate, Felix White's mate, saw him at Heathrow, sent a photo to Felix. This was before Felix was massive in cricket. And so he sent it to me. And obviously, I've never been massive in cricket, but he sent it to me. He said, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? So I'd had a drink and I just popped it on the Twitters.
Absolute scurrilous stuff.
Shocking. I did not know that. You were the person who
I merely stated a fact. Ben Stokes at Heathrow with his big England cricket bag on his back.
Yeah. And he did fly out to play cricket, just in New Zealand rather than Australia.
Just somewhere else.
I feel like I've just, uncovered Watergate here.
No, I mean, it is out there, Ben. Just met with broad indifference.
Joe, Johnny asks... No, different Johnny.
Why can't I have the gloves back?
what does the pod make of Ian Watmore's sudden departure? How much of it is related to the cancelled Pakistan tour and the struggles with confirming the Ashes tour? Ian Watmore left his role at ECB... less than a year in this week. You interviewed him not that long ago.
Yeah, and I was really impressed by him at that point and very hopeful that he would bring something to cricket that was much needed in kind of managing to find the centre ground at a time when it was quite hard to see that ground with particularly around the 100, both parts being kind of stretched to the limits. So I was sad to see him go. Again, we don't want to kind of end up speculating. The statement talked about his mental well-being, and then he'd found the job tough and perhaps more demanding than he was expecting. If that's how he feels, obviously he's got to go. I think we could tie ourselves in knots making links to the Pakistan series. He certainly personally got a lot of criticism, and he might look back with regret that he didn't come out and speak sooner, and may look back with regret that England didn't go. But to say that those two things are linked, I don't know. That would be guesswork. There's certainly been, actually Phil was talking about a piece that Mike Atherton wrote, which I haven't read yet, saying that the meeting with the county chairman hadn't gone well.
Yeah, Atherton flagged that up. De Bell did as well. I spoke to one or two other people who were in that meeting, and yeah, it was a messy meeting, quite an incoherent meeting, I think. And then after that, there was a feeling among the county power brokers that it was probably best for all parties if they shook hands on it and the door was offered to Watmore. And I think he walked through it without a moment's hesitation. I think it's been quite a scarring experience for him. And it was a peculiar appointment now, looking back on in hindsight, because, and you spoke to him, didn't you, Joe? But, you know, he hadn't held a position of high profile authority for 9 years since 2012. He'd worked at the FA for something like 9 or 10 months, wasn't it, I think?
10 months. And I just pulled out that quote, which I thought was interesting, because I questioned him. Look, you only last 10 months in that role. Why won't we see the same thing again? Why won't you just leave the ECB after the same period of time? Which is obviously what has happened. And he hasn't necessarily gone to a huge amount of detail. Why, at that point, when I asked him about the FA, he said the problem was the governance of football was broken. As I said at the time to people, the board of the FA resembled Yugoslavia in the 90s. Well, is there an element too that the ECB perhaps isn't what he wanted it to be as an organisation, and he feels that he can't do the things he wants to within it? That's why he left the FA after less than a year. We don't know if that's part of the reason why he's left the ECB so quickly too. But it's given everything that's gone on over the last few months, I don't think it's too much of a jump to kind of speculate that might have been a contributing factor.
He took on a monstrously difficult job. A very difficult time, you know, in the guts of COVID, the money drain, the 100 postponed, rolling through to this summer, redundancies. From what people have told me who know him better than we do round here, and I've never met him, by the way. Joe's interviewed him, but I've never met him. But someone who does know him relatively well in the journalism game, and they said to me that he was really done in by that, you know. Even his least favoured people in the game still say he's a very decent, straight up, upstanding kind of bloke. And I think having to step in to the shit show of last summer and make 62 people redundant. And then, of course, there was the bonus scandal as well, which was in place long before he was put in charge. I've also heard that some of the other big power players in the ECB's top offices didn't necessarily take to his style of management or leadership that well. So it can't have been a particularly smooth and cohesive working environment. My instinct, I kind of felt sorry for the bloke, actually. But then to read other kind of bigger voices in the game, they said, and Atherton wrote very sort of straightforwardly and sternly, he's got to go, he had to go, you know. He's the top man in an organisation that looked greedy and arrogant and imperialistic and all the rest of it through the Pakistan stuff, and he had no his position was untenable. As I say, when that door was opened, he walked through it, and I don't think he turned around for half a second.
Mm, that is interesting. Thanks again for all your questions this week. Sorry, we don't have time to read them all out, but they are really all appreciated. You can send them in to podcast@wisden.com. They don't have to be about the last week in cricket. They can be about anything vaguely cricket related. Ben, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week was from last night's IPL game between Royal Challengers Bangalore and Kolkata Knight Riders.
The Nareen
performance.
This is the Naren performance, or Narine performance. Basically, Son Heung-min has had a very weird couple of years, and has gone from, you know, obviously got called for chucking, banned, out of the game, come back in, back to the peak of his profession, incredible player in the IPL, then has a massive dip in the last few years where suddenly everyone thinks he's gone. And he suddenly starts, he's not turning the ball, he's not taking wickets, and he's going for runs, which for statistically the best run preserver ever in the game is mad. And suddenly everyone's going, okay, well, he's finished. Because when a player that extreme goes off a cliff, you think that he's done.
Was there like an accusation basically that post-chucking ban that he wasn't the same bowler?
Yeah, I'd say that was very strong.
And he wouldn't be the first bowler that's happened to.
Well, exactly. It's a classic arc, isn't it? You know, you steal a march on everyone and then people call you and then you can't come back the same player. But actually, he's come back in, and on these grubby, horrible wickets in the UAE, which are ragging and turning, he's ragging and turning it hugely, and he's doing really, really, really well. And last night's performance, where he basically plays the most perfect Sunil Narine encapsulation of everything in his career, where he rags it square, gets Kohli, gets Maxwell, gets AB de Villiers in a knockout game in the IPL, takes four wickets for sod all runs, and then comes out and hits his first two balls for six and plays a match-winning cameo with the bat. And I was talking to Matt Roller of Crick Info last night, and we were chatting it through, and I just think that Narine, regardless of the context of this game and his own personal narrative, I think in some ways he sums up all about T20, both the good and the bad. It's the all-round skill of this maverick guy who has this extreme technique and this extreme ability, and as a result, this extreme record. You know, he'd run a ball for his entire career in a game where people are trying to whack you at the ground. He's also got this slight sense of being a bit of a mercenary and it doesn't feel that joyful. It feels a little bit, you know, with the deadpan face and no real, you know, extravaganza or excitement when he's taking wickets. It's all very a bit flat and it feels a bit for hire. And I don't, you know, it's hard to warm to him. But at the same time, he exists at the absolute, you know, he is an epochal player, eking every inch out of his game in terms of suddenly becoming this incredibly versatile batsman as well. And so I just thought that it was quite apt that in this one game, in a hugely important match against, you know, a star-studded batting lineup featuring the best batsman in the tournament in Maxwell, he stepped up again and showed exactly why he is considered, you know, statistically, cricket-wise, the best T20 player of all time. And it's just nice when you have one game, almost like a little museum piece of like, that is the guy. And now KKR are through to the next stage of the IPL, and hope, you know, fingers crossed, for Owen Morgan's sake, they're going to be lifting the trophy on Sunday afternoon.
But he's not going to the T20 World Cup.
No.
On the grounds that he failed a fitness test.
On the grounds that he didn't turn up for the fitness test, I think, is the accusation. There's obviously going to be issues there in terms of his action as well, that actually the IPL is somewhat more lenient to people who may be chucking. I'm not saying he is, but, you know. Well, he's bowling in short sleeves now, so he's clearly he's trying to, you know, make a statement. But I think there is a general sense that the ICC in their flagship tournament would not be quite so lenient. And so there's an argument to that. And do you take that risk of taking a guy to the World Cup who gets called in his first game? Probably not. Do you take that risk if it's the best bowler in the world, potentially? Yeah, maybe. So I'm very much on the fence about it, but I think that's why he's not going, regardless of whether it's a good decision or not.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't think we've really talked about it on the show, but there's a guy called Umran Malik. He's 21-year-old playing for Sunrisers Hyderabad, who is already the fastest Indian bowler of all time. He's at 95 miles per hour in just his third professional game, which is just amazing.
Where's he been? Because I haven't
Kashmir.
Seen...
Yeah.
Is it?
He's been in Kashmir, and he's... Yeah. I guess there's not been as much domestic Indian cricket because of COVID.
Yeah.
So someone like him would have played a bit more before...
And how old is he?
21.
Right.
He's going to make a lot of money.
Yeah. we got an interview with Danny Morrison.
Have you
coming
not seen
up.
Footage of him yet?
I've seen footage, yeah. I just haven't read the backstory yet.
Looks a lot like Wacker, basically.
Absolute gas. And also, it's even more exciting because Sunrisers have been absolutely awful all season. Yeah. And the main reason is because their attack has no ball speed. And so it's just been Sandeep Sharma and Booby banging it on a length. And all of a sudden, it's like, bam, fastest bowler in the competition and Indian history.
But I don't understand. But he would have been bowling that in the nets. And they were doing so badly. He's like, why not give this guy a game when you're still in the competition?
Yeah, I mean, maybe to like dislodge Booby and Sandeep, who've got excellent IPL records, is one thing. But if Sid Call's getting a game over this guy, it's not overseas. If he was an overseas, you'd get him in the side, and he's, you know, he's a domestic player. Like,
it's always one of those fun games. Who does that player look like? And you know, the more obscure the comparison, and also the more kind of vague the comparison, almost that proves your stripes in cricket.
Hipster points, yeah.
But yeah, all of that.
he looks so much like Wacker Yunus, it's actually creepy. It's actually weird. And I don't know if he's actively, consciously modelled himself on him or not. I don't know. But and apparently there's now a split screen, on Twitter or something or other. But I saw him... I saw some footage because Ben Gardner said, oh, you've got to see this kid. Obviously, I didn't see the game live. Christ. And I watched it. And before the ball had even got down there, I was Wacker. It's Wacker. And then I heard the commentary and it's Danny Morris. And he said, oh, yeah, it's Wacker. And everybody, it's like a mirror image. It's extraordinary to see it.
Yeah.
There is no interpretation required on this one. It's just like watching Wacker.
My nichest comparison is, I think, Nassim Shah has got a very similar action to Martin Bicknell. Obviously, a very different very different speeds. But I think
come the dark winter months when England are already 3-0 down, we can do a whole episode on this.
Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So mine is from County Cricket the signing of Sam Northeast by Glamorgan, which he's had a funny old year, Northeast. Mm. He left Hampshire having fallen out with them. To be honest, I don't know exactly the reasons behind that. I'm actually interviewing him tomorrow, so I might have a bit more next week. I think he played 8 games for Hants, then ended up at Yorkshire for 2 games, then went to Notts for 2 games. And you're kind of thinking by the end of the season, he got a few runs for Notts. He probably just goes to Notts.
Got dropped from their side, though, at the very, very end of the season when Hamid came back from England duty.
Sure, but then Hamid will be playing for England. He might not be. But, you know, they Notts often just hoover up those kind of talented batters. Press release comes through that he's gone to Glamorgan. I like the fact he said that the they won silverware was a big draw for him. You know, this is the one day cup that everyone's written off, and he's seeing them as a county who have actually won something recently. He's 31, and he's obviously the heir apparent to James Hildreth as the why has he never played for England, and that's been going on for a few years now. Over the last couple of years, he just hasn't got the runs to be even in the conversation. I think he's averaging 27, 28 over the last 2 years. But he will be continue to be that guy who's got 25 first-class hundreds. Why has he never got a go when so many other players who have got pretty poor records have got a go at some point? And there have certainly been times over the years when he's got a lot of runs and he's not even made the Lions. And you think, why doesn't the face fit on this one? So it'll be interesting. Glamorgan, some would see it as, right, I'm focusing on county cricket. England's behind me. That's not what he said in his initial kind of video that he still wants to go on and play international level. But I thought it was kind of a heartening signing. You just expect these players, the big players of county cricket, when they're available, to end up going to a test match venue, Division One side. And it's a kind of mark of Glamorgan's ambition.
Yeah, I think it was in the England Lions squad that went to Australia at the start of 2020. But then wasn't in that 55-man
big one,
which was the killer, wasn't it? That was the sign that you are not wanted.
Yeah, I think it's quite a smart move, actually. I think Sophia Gardens has been it's been a pretty good wicket to bat on recently. Kieran Carlson's got a lot of runs there. Obviously, Labuschagne got millions the year before. So it's a good wicket. If you've got a conference system in 2022, you're going to still play against the best counties. So I think it is a reasonably smart
It'd be interesting to know if that was part of the decision, that actually there is still access to that high-level prominent cricket. If you do nail it for 6 games or whatever it is, you can actually...
Yeah.
You can still make those big incisions on the on the domestic circuit. I think it'll be interesting. You can completely see, like in terms of like simulate game stuff, you can see Northeast averaging 70 for most of next summer, or averaging 80, and then everyone being like, get this guy in the side. It feels so believable because he's got that bank of runs. Was it the start of the 2019 season or 2018 when he broke his hand at the Oval?
Yeah, I can't remember which.
It was one of the two, and it was like, and that was when he was about to play, and I was all over it and was so excited because his underlying numbers for years have been brilliant. And even though his runs have dropped off, his underlying numbers are still really good. His control's still really good. So I think there's still a player there, and it'd be lovely to have him back at the top of his game.
But he's also, he's 31 year old. He's made 25 hundreds in his whole career. He's been given, he's played 182 first class matches. That's a lot of cricket to get to a point here when you're now playing for your fourth club, albeit only your third on a proper contract. Why are we still obsessing over a batsman who's never quite really cracked it, in truth?
I'd really take issue with obsess for
at 31, but he remains this topic, you know, the Sam Northeast enigma. Is it because he made 1600s in a year for Harrow School when he was 16 or something. I've never quite understood it. I really like watching him play, but I've never really got the sense that a player who is pushing up to 30-odd warrants this kind of
foundation. There are very few players that have had that Hildreth quality of why haven't they played for England. And also, part of the reason probably people are still obsessing over him is because he's probably not played for England. If he comes in for England and he looks...
It's amazing how good you are when you don't play for England.
It's Tom Wesleyism, isn't it? It's like, Wesley's like the great lost talent, and then all of a sudden he plays a couple of tests, and you're like, yeah, he's a good player. Yeah. And then he goes away and no one really cares.
Yeah.
And I think that makes quite a big difference.
I think it
also,
is.
Also, genuinely, I think... he manages his media presence pretty well, doing the podcast with Vision Will. I think that helps because people know who he is. If he's just, you know, county cricketer 32691, doesn't really matter, but, you know, relatively prominent.
But I think if you look at his numbers, they've just got his kind of first class averages by the season up here. And there are a lot of very good seasons which cause excitement. And then he'll have a couple which are rubbish. And then you lose a bit of that. And I think that's why if he just averaged 37 every year for the last 10 years, there wouldn't have been that kind of excitement. When I think that kind of piques people's interest. You know, well, how is he able to do that and not play for England?
Do you want to be Chris Dent, i.e. just very, very quite good for a long time? Or do you want to have those highs and those lows?
It's a good comparison. And Hildreth did it to an extent as well, where he had absolutely phenomenal years where it was almost inconceivable that he hadn't got a chance of England. And people still talk about Hildreth, even though he's not made a run for three seasons now, really. Mm.
I was wondering if, because of his move to Glamorgan, whether North East had played for the southernmost and westernmost counties.
Jesus Christ,
but not quite, because Hove is marginally more southern than the Aegeus Bowl.
Well, there's still time.
This is when you come alive, yes.
We've still got to talk about the World Cup.
Good point.
My moment of the week, by the way, is Amy Hunter of Ireland becoming the youngest ever international centurion. 16th birthday. Yeah. So she scored 100 for Ireland against Zimbabwe, literally on her 16th birthday. So that's the fastest international 100 across formats, men's game, women's game. That is the record. So what did you do on your 16th birthday?
What, on the actual birthday?
On your actual birthday?
Oh, God, wow. I could tell you what happened that summer of 96.
that's the podcast that's a, special. That's
the Isle of Wight Festival. And I'm not talking about music.
Excellent. Anyway, as mentioned earlier, this podcast
is
in association with Las Who. Las Who gives fans the opportunity to book live video chats with an incredible roster of sports stars. Las Who is the new must-have app for any sports fan. One Las Who hero is Danny Morrison, who I talked to yesterday. Hi, Danny. Great to have you on the show. We're recording this the morning after MS Dhoni's 18-6 helped CSK qualify for the final in the last over against DC. A lot of people, but possibly myself included, had written off Dhoni. Above anything else, how special a moment was that?
Yes, well, it is. I mean, even saying so much being chatted about already on social media and everywhere that he rolled back the years, didn't he? Rolled back the clock. I think we all think back to that World Cup of 2011 when he nailed it and finished the game in similar style. He really is quite exceptional. And like you said, so many people have probably written them off after such a difficult time last year. So, yeah, great to see. And I'm pleased for MS because he is one of those greats. He really is a modern great. And I think I say life isn't fair, yes, is it? I mean, you say like he deserves to go out like this, but so many don't. But good on him. I'm pleased he's writing another chapter.
And I felt from a tournament point of view as well, the IPL needed something like this. The UAE leg has felt a little bit flat for me compared to what was the previous tournaments. What do you think the difference has been for CSK this season? They were the first team to be knocked out in 2020 and they're the first team to qualify for the final in 2021.
Got rid of that slack old Aussie, Shane Watson. I think we all were quite agreeance and I wasn't alone. Many of colleagues saying, look, they're aging. They're getting a bit long in the tooth, aren't they? And certainly with Shane Watson, he's moved on. We knew it was his last gig, last time here in the UAE. That was IPL 13. So, and MSD himself, you know, by his own admission, didn't have a good time of it. And I think all those combinations of aging guys, DJ Bravo, all of that sort of scenario, we all know you can't play forever. So I'm pleased for them. I've always been a fan of Dhoni. Of course we have. Just the way he conducts himself and how mellow he is. He's this really quiet, achieving sort of rock star, if you like, of the modern era in terms of, you know, T20. So, yeah, I just think, again, you know, they're older guys. Cyrus Rayner himself too, you know, he hasn't played much either. So you can see where someone like Robin Utapa comes in. And I'm pleased for Robin Utapa too, because he's of that ilk, you know, he's getting on. And some of the old guns doing it, mixing in with the younger brigades, with Daikwad. Isn't he exciting? And I think that's just typical of India, producing more and more stars.
Yeah, Gaikwad's been a revelation. I find it amazing how in such a high-quality league, there are always a few relative unknowns who from nowhere are right up there with the most effective performers in the competition. Speaking of which, have you seen much of Umran Malik, the Sunrisers youngster who's hitting 150Ks?
Well, exciting. I was on air here in Abu Dhabi, and he really did excite. And a lot of us, you know, were on commentating about his run-up and stuff and making comparisons about the great Waqar Yunus. In terms of his balance and his approach was very Waqar. And then even his load up through the delivery, I think we put that on Twitter and social media, that you know, a couple of guys even put split screens and showed both of them running in and delivering. And so once again, yes, that's what this tournament's about, isn't it, too, to be fair. You're unearthing talent, and particularly for India because it's their league, and you're going to get that Gaikwad there. And what about... the Ayers, the two of them not related, but, you know, these guys are just exceptional. I mean, look at Rishabh Pant's come through with that. Ishan Kishan, you know, he's shown recently what he can do. You've got all these guys coming through that are just very, very exciting.
And obviously the T20 World Cup is just around the corner, taking place predominantly in the UAE. You're there right now. What can we expect from the pitches out there?
Well, it's funny because we were here last year and Simon Dool and I were chatting about it in the Caribbean, because India have picked a lot of spinners in their squad, and you'd expect possibly the pitchers to get tired. But it is a neutral tournament in a way. It's supposed to be. I know it was supposed to be in India. It's not. It's here. And if the pitchers have got that tinge of green about them, which they need, and I know I think subcontinent fans get a bit freaked out, and even the players do, subcontinental players go, oh, look at the green. Well, I think it's so hard and dries out very quickly here, given that we're in the UAE, hello, that, you know, you have to have grass, and grass creates pace. It doesn't necessarily mean lots of sideways movement, like if you're playing at, you know, test matches in England or New Zealand in particular, those sort of conditions, it's not. They're so hard, and the grass just adds as a bit of a canopy to make the ball slide on. And then we know spinners can still get grip off grass, so it's not impossible that. So I think you can get lulled into a false sense of security, particularly we've seen that the pacers, they're the ones who take most of the wickets. Even though the spinners have a say, they may not quite take as many wickets, but they still dominate because they go for less. Their economy is so much more powerful. And I think, you know, be wary of surfaces where the pace men, if they're smart, and they are, lots of cutters, lots of changes, pace off the ball, tennis ball bounces that don't arrive, and then good Yorkers wide, and we know all the strategies. But I think, yeah, be careful. Sharjah, to me, yes, is a bit of a worry because it can be slick there, but it has been very mosaic, and it has been slow and tough to score decently past 160, 165. So, yeah, I mean, that looks like that's going to be more, you know, for the spinners and hard work for the batsmen. But the other ones, geez, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, it can be quite good for shot making. But it does rely on the ground stuff, and it'll be fascinating to see what they produce.
The T20 World Cup kicks off this week. I'm just going to run through the format because I don't think everyone will be that familiar with it. The first round consists of two groups of four. The top two from each of those groups qualifies for the Super 12s, which are two groups of six, and the top two from those groups qualify for the semi-finals, and then you've got your final, etc. Ireland captain Andrew Balburny, after his side qualified for the first round of the World Cup in 2019, tweeted, "Thrilled to qualify for another qualifier," which I think sums up that part of the tournament pretty well. Group A's got Ireland, Namibia, Netherlands and Sri Lanka. Group B consists of Bangladesh, Oman, Papua New Guinea and Scotland. I'll just run through a few of those teams quite quickly. Ireland aren't in great form. They've recently lost a series to UAE, who didn't qualify for the tournament. Namibia are doing very well. They've won three games in a row. Before the show, I was looking up their overall T20I record. They've only ever lost four T20Is and they played 22, which is good going. Ben, you wrote a preview of the tournament in the upcoming Wisden Cricket Monthly, and you like the Netherlands.
Yeah, I think, I think it's just the fact that in that group, I think there's some interesting stories. The Netherlands have got a very, very good all-round team. I think if you look at if you did a combined 11 between them and Ireland, who are obviously also in that group, you'd probably only have a couple of Irish players in there, probably Balburnie, probably Sterling, obviously. And then it maybe Little, but you're skimping at that point. They've got a really good side, so they're the second best team in that group. They're arguably the best team in that group because Sri Lanka, as we know, are rubbish. So I think that you could make a very reasonable case that the Netherlands are going to top that group, which would be really exciting. It's slightly unfortunate, I think, given the way that the ICC have structured the seedings, that even if the Netherlands go through as winners, they still essentially go through as in second place. Yeah. Basically, if Sri Lanka or Bangladesh qualify, they qualify as group winners into a particular group.
Yeah, that's a bit of madness, that.
I don't quite understand. I think ostensibly it was so that the fans could go, and so that it was easier to plan for fans to go and visit the games. But obviously, in this current environment, that seems a little bit odd. I don't know the exact reason, but it feels a bit jarring when I think there is a genuine story there in terms of the Netherlands could rock up, and it would barely be a shock if they beat Sri Lanka. They are that strong. I think the other group is a little bit different in terms of Bangladesh are a very good side. They're world ranked number 6. They are a proper team. It's a bit weird that they're in that group. And so the other three who are among them, they are going to be scrapping. It's going to be kind of three knockout games, basically. You know, if PNG turns Scotland over, they're right in amongst it again. So I think that's probably going to be a slightly less interesting group. But the Netherlands, yeah, they're the ones to watch, I think.
Yeah, Group B is quite interesting because Bangladesh are so much stronger than the other three sides. And the other three sides are Scotland, PNG and Oman, who are arguably weaker than all three of the teams that are in the other group. So you're going to have one of those teams in the Super 12s playing five games against the top sides in the world, which is going to be quite interesting. Anyway, moving on to the Super 12s.
Just really quickly, the format's not for the next World Cup, but the following World Cup is the one which I think we all want, which is four groups of five. So that I think that pretty much solves the format issue. This is a bit of a shonky, cobbled together idea, but proper, football style, four groups, whoever wins goes through. I think that's better, and hopefully we can get to that sooner rather than later.
Anyway, moving on to the Super 12s. In Group 1, you've got Australia, England, South Africa, West Indies. Joe, who are you picking to qualify from those four plus the other two qualifiers?
I've been thinking about this a bit recently. I'm watching Morgan's travails at the IPL, Livingston seeming to bat himself out of form, quite a lopsided squad in terms of their bowling attack with not enough spin. I think West Indies will beat England in their opener, and then England basically can't lose a game from that point in, probably. I'm watching Glenn Maxwell at the IPL. I do think England might miss out. I think it feels a bit like the energy is heading that way, and perhaps that's more my energy than England's. I think West Indies and Australia from that squad, from that group.
Do you think England got their squad composition wrong? They've only got two spinners, arguably. I mean, Moeen doesn't often bowl four overs in the IPL. India have picked five. Owen Morgan's KKR side that's doing very well in the IPL, they've got three spinners in their 11.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Morgan's not having a good campaign personally, but the way he's managed his spinners has been really interesting, and KKR have been very, very extreme, using a lot of spin in the power play. I think more spin in the power play than any team ever in the IPL. They've really gone with that. And England could do that. You could bowl Moeen in the power play. They tried Rashid in the power play against India in the five-match series. So it is there. It's not out of the question. But then you've got Liam Livingstone as your main spinner through the middle. Because they haven't picked Parkinson or Liam Dawson or Jake Lintott or Mason Crane, they are a bit lopsided, like you say. I think it leaves them a little bit short. But I'm still a bit more optimistic than Joe. I think that whilst England are out of form, the guys who are at the IPL are out of form, but you've got Joss Butler to come back in. You've got Johnny Bairstow to come back in. I think both of those guys are world class, and I think that's pretty straightforward. They will improve, and they are good players who they can rely on to find form. Mark Wood is a guy who can devastate any attack, any batting order in the world. I think the issue for England, the biggest loss, is obviously Jofra Archer. You have Jofra Archer in that side, doesn't really matter what pitches you've got, doesn't matter who you're coming up against, he's going to take 2 weeks with a new ball and he's not going to concede a run. He's a genius. That's the biggest issue. The fact that they've lost Sam Curran and Ben Stokes
is a proper issue because it means they can't balance the side. They basically now need to either commit wholeheartedly to a batting heavy strategy or to a really bowling heavy strategy with someone like Chris Wokes at number seven, which makes me, you know, gives me the heebie-jeebies a little bit.
So you go batting heavy?
I think I'd just about go batting heavy. I want to be able to be more creative with Moeen. I want to have a bit of fun. I want to have him floating up and down the order. But I think England pretty much just need to go back to, you know, Milan comes back in. They're a little bit more, just list your best batsmen and then hope that the bowlers turn up. Because to be honest, I'm just nervous about England on those pitches. I think they need so much from Butler and Bairstow that they're not going to blast teams away in the way that they have in the past. It's going to come down to, can Jason Roy dominate in the power play on these sticky pitches where scoring 60 in the power play and then backing it up with, like, you know, 90 for the next 14 overs is quite common now. If Roy can get it, go out, and then Bairstow and Butler can manage the middle overs, and then whatever you get from Morgan is a bit of a bonus. I think that's the way you go about it. But genuinely, it will feel like we're all sitting here thinking, you know, England are, you know, they're mucking this up here. It's all going the wrong way. And you're right, the energy does feel a little bit more 2015 World Cup than 2019 World Cup. But at the same time, you look at the other teams, Australia aren't very good, South Africa aren't very good, the West Indies are brilliant. If England beat those two sides, which they should, maxi apart, I don't think there's too much to hurt them.
And I would say, yeah, as a caveat to what I said, I think they are fortunate they're in the group they are. If they were in a group with India and Pakistan, I really wouldn't back them. As it stands, I think they're, you know, it feels like a kind of 50-50 chance to me at this point, certainly that first West Indies game.
Phil, we've talked a lot about Johnny Bairstow and Josh Butler recently. We had a question in about how much the media focuses on the Ashes when you've literally got a World Cup starting next week.
Yeah.
And for these players, Bairstow and Butler, as Ben says, they're absolutely essential to England's World Cup hopes. They've got an absolutely enormous 4 months coming up, career defining in two formats, completely different, and we almost neglect how important that both of those are and almost take them for granted.
Yeah, I think with this particular tournament, there's an element of the unknown with it. And I'm not just covering my back. you know, if you speak to people, if you speak to friends about it, then they want to talk about the Ashes. They don't want to talk about the T20 World Cup. But what will happen with the T20 World Cup is that it will build like World Cups do in sport. It's hard to get excited about a tournament that is out in the middle of nowhere and it's been cobbled together and it shouldn't even really be played there, but there's obvious reasons why it has to be. And then there's going to be this bit at the beginning that will be fun, but broadly inconsequential to English cricket fans. And then you'll get there and then you'll play a handful of games and then it will start to build. And then by the end of it, everyone will be crowding round for the final stages to see what's going to play out and if England are going to pull it off. Of course that will happen. But the thing with the Ashes is that I don't really think it's a fair comparison because we know what that is and we know when it starts and we know what it's going to look like and we know how it's going to feel. So we can prepare ourselves for it. Whereas this tournament it's not yet developed a reputation, not yet developed its own identity.
I think you're right. I've made this point on the podcast before. T20 is a completely, it's taken completely differently in terms of like how seriously people take it now compared to the last World Cup in 2016. There have been, I think, six IPLs since the last World Cup.
Even the fact that this one is called a World Cup and it's not a World T20, yeah. It's almost like it's graduated to being big boy cricket.
It's been 5 years since Bangalore 2016. There's another one next year and then it'll be every 2 years from there on in, right? I think that's a good thing. I think that's necessary to establish international T20 cricket. If it's going to be played at all, then I like it being every couple of years. I think that fits for that format. I've always been a bit ambivalent about international teams playing it because they play a hell of a lot of cricket anyway and it works so well domestically. But if we are going to play it, and I think we should, and I think to have, you don't have to play that much of it in the interim. It's not like you've got to tune up as an England T20 side. You come together for a couple of weeks before the big thing and you go out and play for every 2 years. I like that. I think it's necessary for the format played at international level. But going into this tournament, if we feel, or if the average punter feels a little bit unsure about how to feel about it, then that's entirely understandable. We're a week out of a very long summer that we've just sweated buckets for. So it's understandable if people are kind of looking at it and not quite sure what it looks like yet.
I think that's completely fair. And also I think it is underrated like how much
you know, I think the idea that, you know, England announced the Ashes squad, that means that people are going to talk about that because that's, you know, it's journalists' jobs to cover what the news is, and that's the news, is the England announced the Ashes squad. So, you know, just because they're not writing tactical pieces about, you know, whether or not Case Armour should be the Afghanistan squad or not.
Someone's going to.
Leave them all for me. I'm quite happy. I'll hoover them up. But what I would say as well is I think it's quite interesting that in 2016, there was a big momentum behind T20. What it did feel like the first big proper tournament where people took it seriously. It wasn't just, oh, is that on? It was serious cricket. And so, but it also happened to be the moment when they extended it to 4 years. And by extending it to 4 years, it gave it a grandeur and it made it feel like this isn't, you know, we're not just doing this.
Would you keep it at 4 years?
Well, I don't really mind. I like it every 2 years because I like T20 cricket more than most other cricket. So I want to get more in there. But I also think that every 4 years feels a bit more like it's a cycle and you build towards it. And it means that you could have a couple of years where you don't play very much of it. So you could, that in those years before the ODI World Cup, you have more ODIs and fewer T20s and then you build up towards it. But again, like, I don't really mind. But the point is that when they delayed it from 2 years to 4 years, they weren't expecting it to be 5 years. So it does feel like T20 has changed its identity in this time. You know, the PSL's been started. The BBL's expanded again. All these big structural changes. We've had the 100, we've had the T10. The game has changed. And the World Cup is a marker of that. It's a time when you kind of sit back and you reflect and think, yeah, shit, this is how far this game has come.
Are you watching the Dubai T10 stuff yet?
I'm not that much of a pervert.
Have you dragged yourself into that particular gutter?
No, I leave that to Freddie to feed back my kind of CFAT.
Throw a damning on Freddie. Yeah. There is a...
No. Throw him under the bus.
I don't want to slag him off while he's not here. But equally, he did send me a picture the other day of his double screen at home, he had his laptop, he had the Pakistan T20 cup on, and he had the IPL on, and he was the happiest I've ever seen him in his life. So nice. For those of us who are that obsessed with it all, this World Cup is very, very, very exciting.
Quickly on West Indies, you said that they're an excellent side. To a T20 layman, you know, you look through their squad and you're kind of wondering who are their star bowlers. You've got Jason Holder and Sheldon Cottrell, who are two established internationals who are in the reserves. Ravi Rampal's back at 37.
Yeah,
and Obed McCoy, who I don't think people know a huge amount, is rated pretty highly.
McCoy is really good. He is a really, really exciting player. And I think that he's the kind of guy who needs to turn up and have an above average tournament if the West Indies are going to go deep. Because as much as the batting is incredible, and I think because it's familiar, we skate over it. But it is absolutely absurd, the players that they have in that batting lineup, particularly if Russell is fully fit and can balance.
I was going to say,
I think he's likely to be fit to bat, but not likely to be fit to bowl, which is, you know, Taylor's oldest time in the last few years. But I would say, McCoy is interesting. The issue is, and again, it comes back to Narayan, is that I was saying yesterday, I don't think there's a bigger drop off in terms of a player to the next best for their side in a particular role than Narayan to the next best West Indies spinner. You know, Fabian Allen is a good, exciting player, but he's not a brilliant bowler. Hayden Walsh Jr. is basically there because he's a wrist spinner, not really because he's any good. And so they are going to struggle. They're going to have to out-hit teams. It's just that they probably do still have the batting lineup to do it. And particularly now that Hetmyer's found form in the IPL, Perrin's, you know, on a dry spell ever since I said he was going to be the best player in the world. He's absolutely shot through the floor. But hopefully he can find a bit of form because, he, you know, when you're surrounded by those geniuses, how can a bit of it not rub off on you? I think now they're second favourites on these pitches. I think they've jumped ahead of England because
those pitches, obviously you've been watching a lot of it. Are they all going to be scrabbly, dirty things?
No, it's come back the other way. And I think they are. I mean, it's always hard to preempt this stuff because it was relayed just before the tournament. So who knows? It's a bit of an unknown. But what I would say is that it doesn't take very much to make Sharjah incredibly batting friendly because it's so small.
Yeah,
so
tiny,
even
yeah.
It doesn't need to be, you know, an absolute road. It can just be normal and suddenly it's 220 plays 220. Mm. So I'd say that's quite a significant thing. If one of the three venues is like that, Abu Dhabi is spinning, but also none of the pitches are really spinning, but it's offering help to spinners being a bit stop-starty. And Dubai's, you know, basically playing like Dubai normally does. So I don't think they're not slag heaps. They're not horrible, but it's just that I think a lot of people expected it to be, you know, Chinnaswamy in Sharjah. It's not. That's the one that's the cause for concern.
And how many people can we expect through the doors to create a bit of atmosphere? Do you know?
I actually don't know. That's probably pretty one for you.
I think they've said that they've got 70%.
I know. I know. I looked. I tried to buy a ticket for the final because I was trying to see if I could extend my stay, and I decided it was financially ruinous.
Okay.
So there's clearly got enough of an audience to be able to charge what they want.
Okay. Anyway, Group 2 has got India, New Zealand, Pakistan, Afghanistan and two qualifiers. Joe, you said you're glad that England aren't in a group with India and Pakistan. Pakistan are interesting. They've all their recent turmoil, that's generally how they roll. They'll probably do quite well. But I thought when they came over to England early in the summer against a strong England team, they pushed England really, really, really hard in English conditions. So you'd probably back them to qualify from that group alongside India?
It feels like it's going that way, doesn't it? It feels like they've got, I mean, two absolute gun batters in Babar and Rizwan. That bowling attack's formidable anywhere, but particularly in UAE where they're so used to playing some international cricket in the past, but particularly PSL. It just looks well set up for them. And I think, I mean, India-Pakistan is going to be one hell of a game, and I wouldn't be surprised if they then meet each other in the final after that, which I think is what you predicted as well, isn't it? Is that what you...
Oh God. England runners up in the magazine.
Yeah, okay. But that was about 3 weeks ago before I realised that, you know, everything's changed. In the lifespan of T20 cricket, that's a long time. I would say with Pakistan, it's a shame that they've made the changes to the squad that they've made. I think they've become slightly less exciting. Azam Khan is obviously such an extreme player, and you can, you know...
Is it Moeen's son?
Yes, I think he is his son, and it's... But he's the third fastest scorer against spin in history. He just stands there and whacks it, and he, you know, hits three out the ground and then walks off. He's not a particularly old-fashioned cricketer. He just gives it a whack, and he's been dropped out because he's inconsistent, apparently. And so they've gone back to Shoaib Malik. The year is still 2021, if you are checking. And then you've got the loss of Shoaib Maksud. I think is a real shame. He's going to be injured for the World Cup, and he's, you know, been a PSL gun in terms of hitting sixes. And the one thing, whilst Babar and Rizwan are excellent and will be very good, useful on those pitches to navigate and, you know, get through the early stages. They lacked a bit of firepower. Azam and Maksud did offer that, as did Kushal Shah. And the fact that they've lost those guys is a little bit of an issue.
It's all about the Morrissey left arm seamer who opens the bowling, the Morrissey Shaheen. Lookalike. He's my favourite bowler out there. I think
he's amazing.
Incredible. And while I haven't been watching too closely of late, you do see stuff on Twitter, clips here and there, and he's just looking sensational at the moment.
I think the battle between...
Is he the best? Is he the best T20 apart from Jofra? Is he the best?
Jofra and Bumrah.
And then after him,
it's him. He's next. Because the only issue is he's slightly more skewed to the new ball. Because he's super aggressive, but he can't come back in the middle and do what Bumrah and Archer do. But I would say he's definitely third best in the world. What I'm so excited for... I mean, we talk about India-Pakistan every tournament, obviously really exciting. But specifically... Shaheen versus Rohit in that game, or Shaheen, like that two over spell at the start while the ball is moving, that is, it won't necessarily just decide the game, but if, you know, gets Rohit, gets Kohli next over, you know, the world's gonna, the roof's gonna come off. It's gonna be absolutely amazing. Like, that is, as micro battles go, Shaheen's as exciting as it comes, and stick him against India, it could be really, really special.
Mm. That's how to get excited about T20 cricket.
I just love it.
There's a really good article, very informative piece on wisdom.com by Rohit Shankar on Shoaib Malik. It's basically just outlining how weird his international cricket, his international career has been. So he's one of very few players who start their international careers in the 20th century. I think in his debut test match he was carded to about 10 but didn't get in. It was against Bangladesh, and I think his last test innings was a golden duck. His last ODI innings was a golden duck, but his last test series was his first in like 5 or 6 years, and it featured a double 100. This is the England series, UAE 2015, and also his career best figures of the ball. So he's, you know, a wonderfully weird career. Joe, I was looking through the New Zealand squad, and it's a bit underwhelming compared to New Zealand squad you're used to in recent major white ball tournaments.
Dark horses.
Dark horses. Absolutely. I'm not sure you can pull that one off anymore, though, can you?
Yeah,
I mean, they've not got a great record in T20 World Cups or World T20s previously anyway. I mean, it's their strength is their seam attack, which, you know, might not necessarily be suited to the conditions hugely. I mean, the lack of a world-class spinner is a problem. And the batting doesn't look explosive. It looks more functional. I suppose Glenn Phillips is probably the kind of the X-factor player who, certainly when we were doing our previews, his T20 international record over the last year is phenomenal. I think his strike rate's about 200, having had a kind of quite tricky start since he came in. I don't know, has he done well since he's gone back to the IPL? I've seen him doing ridiculous stuff in the field.
Glenn Phillips. Yeah. Well, he's only come in for a couple of games for Livingston, and no, he played one
stinker of an innings as they were battered in the last game by Mumbai. And then they, yeah, but mainly just flying from left of picture to, you know, to dive across the line. He is an amazing fielder. Astonishing. What I would say on New Zealand as well is I think it is a bit underwhelming. And the two picks that I took issue with, not hugely, I think Adam Milne being left out or being a travelling reserve for Tim Southee is very odd. Tim Southee is not a good T20 bowler. And Milne is, you know, one of the form players in the world, or has been over the last year, played a lot of cricket really effectively. And I think, yeah, if you're looking for that little bit of firepower to hit some sixes early on, Finn Allen would have been a really interesting go. And I think that whilst he's up and down, he's incredibly raw, but like, geez, look at his record. He hits so many sixes and he's so aggressive. I would also say my main New Zealand take is just that we're talking about pitches. One day I just want to have a whole World Cup played in New Zealand on those absolute roads where everything is 230 v 230. Yeah. That would be like the ultimate neutrals. Like, oh, do you not really watched cricket before? Just watch this. It's just sixes for an hour. It'd be brilliant.
Very quickly, Ben, Afghanistan, you giving them a chance to qualify?
No, but I think they'll be the most exciting team to watch in the tournament. I think Gurbaz and Zaza at the top of the order is not, they're certainly not the best opening pair in the tournament, but maybe the most exciting, both incredibly attacking, but against pace and spin, go really, really hard all the time. But then there's nothing in the middle order apart from Nabi. And then all the spinners. I think it's a bit of a shame they've left Case Ahmed out, because I think there was an opportunity with them using Rashid Khan at number 7, which they've started to do recently more. They could have picked all of them, i.e. Mujib, Nabi, Rashid and Case. Back it up with a bit of Naveen or Hack and maybe one of the seamers, either Shapur or something like that. There's definitely like a team there that could rip through sides. I tell you what, Australia will be absolutely over the moon that they're not in the same group as Afghanistan, because they would have destroyed them, because not one of them can play spin apart from Maxi. So they would have absolutely gone through them. I think they'll scare someone. They'll probably be Pakistani or stop Pakistan going through, because that would be a very Pakistan thing to happen.
Yeah, that is also
but
true.
I'll be watching them very eagerly.
Joe, there's a new magazine out this week. What's in it?
Well, there's the T20 World Cup preview.
Yeah, a lot of that.
You've got Ben, who's written the intro to that. You've got team profiles. You've got a Mohammad Rizwan interview by Saj Sadiq, which is interesting. I mean, he's had a fascinating career. It's taken a long time to kind of be accepted in any format, really. And his record in T20 this year is just phenomenal. We've got my interview with Kyron Pollard, which was done a month or so ago. And he's one. Even though this interview was just done over Zoom, he is definitely one of those cricketers that just, you know, you speak to him and you know you're in the presence of someone who's a significant presence. And it's not often you interview cricketers who are unbelievable players and you start speaking to them and they're perhaps not the most, maybe slightly underwhelming as characters. No chance of that with Pollard, who's got a fascinating, unique story to tell. Doesn't hold back on West Indies cricket boards of old. It was one of the most enjoyable interviews I've done for a while. Phil, what else is in there? Help me out.
Karunya Keshav, yes. The Indian writer, has written something masterful on Afghanistan. The recent history and the immediate future for Afghanistan cricket, obviously in the context of what's happening in the country. She researched it beautifully, spoke to people on the front line. Ends up becoming a really moving piece of work as well as a brilliant piece of journalism. So that I can't recommend that enough. It's one of the best things we've published, I would say. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it was really excellent. I mean, not an easy gig that we gave her at all, and difficult to speak to the people that you'd want to speak to. And yeah, she did an absolute bang-up job, as she always does. Nice interview with John Crawley by Jim Wallace, who, fans of county cricket will no doubt be fans of John Crawley if they were watching in that era, one of the great players to watch at that time, and had a funny England career in that there were, four or five test centuries he hit? Four, I reckon.
No, I thought it was more than that. I thought it was five at least, okay. But maybe not. But he averaged good numbers by the end, but him and Fletcher just dismissed him.
Since that was something like he averaged 46 in his last 10 tests and then got drops. And Crawley tells a nice story, or a not nice story from his point of view, of the moment where he realised that Fletcher didn't back him, didn't think he had the minerals to be a test batter.
No, you're right, Joe, only four.
Four.
I hadn't realised his first class record was that good.
He's a proper player.
46, 5400s.
I mean, you couldn't say quite up there in the sort of Hick, Rambrakash, lost talent kind of thing, but not far off given the numbers he put together for Lancs and Hampshire. So he's a teacher now as well. So that's an interesting look back at his career defining moments.
Our columnists have tried to tackle the so-called issues of the day from the Pakistan debacle, England's arrogant no-show there. We've got Peter Oborne, who's a world authority on Pakistan cricket, to write with kind of righteous yet elegantly phrased fury on the issue. Andrew Miller tackles the thorny subject of the relationship between players and players' boards now in the context of player power. And Adam Collins, who's back, he's written about the Ashes phony war, however you want to put it. And as I say, Karunya's covered off Afghanistan as well. So it's a kind of issue.
We've got Lawrence Booth on the rise of T20 and its unintended consequences. You might not like that one, Ben.
I'll just read mine again.
Oh yeah, I'm sure you will. But yours and Lawrence's balanced each other out well. That was the intention.
It's one of our better front covers, and we do good front covers. And this one's a belter because we scrapped around a bit, Joe and I, talking about how we should approach this particular issue, because conventionally and in times past, big world tournament coming up, you go bells and whistles on that. But it felt like it's been such a kind of unhinged time for the game and discombobulatingly weird time for people following it and for us as fans, that we decided to try and find a sort of dichotomy cover, if you like, you know, contrasting the positivity of a world tournament, let's all get stuck into that, and a recognition that down on planet Earth, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be addressed and sorted out, and a lot of negative stories around the game, unavoidably so. So we tried to settle upon a cover that reflected both of those worlds. You've seen it. Works. It's good, isn't it?
It's very, very
good. That's a leading
question. But yeah, that's me.
Imagine if I hated it. No, it's very, very good. I was very...
Stick that on the bottom. It's very, very good.
I often say that the best employee of Wisden is the designer.
So of course, he has no idea how the process works. It's fine. It's fine. He doesn't know... He's very good on Afghanistan's opening batters, though. So.
I'm just excited that I get my name on the front cover. It's the first time that's ever happened. So.
Steady. That was an early draft.
I should also add, it feels like a long time ago already, but this is our county review as well. So we've gone through, basically reviewed all 18 counties' seasons with a little bit of special attention paid to Warwickshire and Kent as the big winners of the major silverware, with loads of interviews in there as well. So plenty for county fans, even if you don't like the T20 stuff.
Lovely. As always, you can get your magazine at wisden.com/shop.
That does sound like a really good magazine.
Sounds longer than the almanac, but it sounds great.
And finally, naturally, a plug for Justin Langer's LinkedIn account. He only started using this yesterday, but it's fair to say it's been worth the wait. He's posted two posts in the last 2 days, and I'm just going to read out the first one. A wise man once said, "Don't give them a taste of your own medicine. If they lied, let their medicine be honesty. If they played with your emotions, let your medicine be maturity. If they broke you, let your medicine heal you. If they made you cry, let your medicine make them smile. These remedies of yours may take years to work, but they work. And they last. So be patient. Stay true to yourself." I can't do this. And remember this. It is better for people to value you for who you are, not who you pretend to be. Who you are lasts a lifetime. Who you pretend to be changes like the change of seasons. Don't be afraid to be yourself, even if it means removing yourself from lives you want to be in. You are, no doubt, worthy of being valued for who you are. So be who you are. The wise man says, be yourself. This is all in capitals, by the way. Be yourself. You are unique and you are special. Be happy, be healthy, be calm, be strong, and be yourself. This was all posted with a photo of a man in a waistcoat puffing on a cigar, sitting on a leather armchair.
It's probably like we made an AI read 1,000 Jordan Peterson books, and here's what it came up with.
Really is extraordinary. There's another one in a remarkable, similar vein that's been posted since then. I wonder if this is going to be a daily thing during the World Cup and the Ashes.
We could do Justin Langer final thought kind of stuff. Don't people only go on LinkedIn when they are looking for a new job?
It's not even a gag, is it? It's just so on the nose. It's just ridiculous.
Anyway, this podcast has been as nearly as long as the James Bond film. But that is all we've got time for today. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Ben. Cheers, Phil. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast in association with Lasso. We'll be back next week. Cheers.
Podcast Network.